In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Following the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from the Great White North and his studio beneath the stairs. Here's Richard.
And welcome once again to Strange Planet, and we are going to delve into one of my favorite topics, and that is climate change and sustainable development. Steve Gorham is Executive Director of the Climate Science Coalition of America and author of 3 books on energy, climate change, and sustainable development, and with over 100,000 copies in print. His latest book is Outside the Green Box, Rethinking Sustainable Development. Steve, welcome. How are you?
Richard, I'm doing great. Great to join you.
I've been talking about climate change for probably close to 20 years. I go back to, I was interviewing people on the Oregon Petition. Do you remember the Oregon Petition?
I do.
In the mid-2000s. I have a daily radio program, and I dedicate one segment every week with Tony Heller. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Tony Heller, and we talk about these things as well.
Sounds familiar. Yeah. I can't place him right now, but go ahead.
He has a website called realclimatescience.com.
We'll
get into COP27, but I want to jump right just to last week, and they had the WEF conference, and we had Al Gore talking about, you know, how we have to act immediately and we have to act quicker because he actually said the oceans are boiling.
Yes.
The level of hyperbole now has reached a whole new height. John Kerry saying that 50% of our species are extinct, which is completely false. Do you get the sense that they are starting to panic?
Well, the alarms keep getting bigger and bigger, don't they, about everything. You know, it is remarkable. I consider this the biggest superstition in modern history, the idea that our very small emissions relative to what nature does of carbon dioxide is causing dangerous temperature rise Mr. Gore said the oceans are boiling, but we've had 1 degree rise in 140 years since 1880. And, you know, I have, sometimes I have, excuse me, I'm getting a phone call I got to get rid of. I had some students from University of Southern California call me up and say, interview me. And then I started asking them questions, of course. And I said, how much do you think world temperatures have risen in the last century? And one said 5 degrees, one said 10 degrees. People really have no concept that in 140 years, we've had a temperature rise that we experience every morning from 9 to 10 a.m. So it's very, very small. The other thing is that we've had warmer temperatures in the past. We've had periods that are multiple centuries long and up to 500 years when it has been warmer than it is today. And so it's very difficult to build a case that human emissions are causing dangerous warming and that natural factors don't dominate. Nevertheless, the world has by and large accepted this, and it's spending over $500 billion a year on wind and solar and renewables trying to control global temperatures. Really an amazing and superstitious situation.
Right, as you say, you know, trillions of dollars, and it's all about, as you point out, like 1 degree. They want to keep, what is this argument about, it's all about 1 degree?
Well, that is the thing. It's very, very small, 1 degree. And these are metrics from the Climate Research Unit in England, NOAA and NASA. They all say about the same thing. They go back to about 1880 was when we had thermometers. By the way, they say when they say this is the warmest in history, they're always talking about thermometer history, which is back to 1880. But we had warmer times before and than we have now. There's never any real solid data for this, but the alarms are there and the scare tactics are there.
So they want to prevent or manage the temperature rise to within, was it 1.5 degrees?
Yes. COP27, which occurred in December, the 27th Conference of the Parties and the United Nations, they have these annual meetings, and that is their goal, that we should have no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius of temperature rise. But it's all based on the mistaken idea that we can control it, which is the height of human arrogance and really not supported by the evidence, at least in my opinion.
Right, this idea that CO2 is driving temperatures,
right.
That it's somehow, it's like a thermostat. Is CO2, do we even know whether CO2 is caused by a temperature rise, is causing temperatures to rise, whether it's a lagging indicator? Do we have any idea?
Well, that's another issue. Let me talk about that first, and then maybe we can get into the greenhouse effect a little bit. But yeah, there has, matter of fact, Mr. Gore used to do presentations, and he would show a chart which showed that CO2 was way up and temperature was way up. The thing is, if you actually go back and look at data over the last several ice ages that geologists look at, we've had four ice ages about 100,000 years long with intervening warm periods about 15,000 years. And if you look closely, you find that temperatures rise about 600 years earlier than the atmospheric CO2 in all of these cases. Mr. Gore was trying to say the CO2 is driving it, but the data really indicates that temperatures are probably the driver. They warm the oceans, and the biosphere emit more carbon dioxide. And then you can go back even farther, and there's very little correlation between carbon dioxide and temperature if you look into the geologic record. But let's talk about the greenhouse effect for a moment. So the greenhouse effect is a theoretical basis for the idea that humans are causing dangerous warming. Light enters our atmosphere from the sun, and what isn't reflected is absorbed by the surface of the Earth. And then the Earth, being a warm body, gives off lower energy infrared radiation. And that goes back out into space to keep the planet in a temperature equilibrium. But most of that infrared is captured by greenhouse gases in our atmosphere. Most of it causes those gases to have their molecules vibrate, and then they re-radiate that energy, and that does tend to warm the surface of the Earth. Some of that comes back down again. And so the proponents of the theory of man-made warming say that our industry is putting carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which is a greenhouse gas, and that is capturing more outgoing infrared radiation and warming the planet. The thing is that misses quite a bit. And often I ask audiences, what is nature's dominant greenhouse gas? And they'll say carbon dioxide, or they'll say methane. But the answer is water vapor. Scientists, and this really isn't in dispute, scientists estimate that somewhere between 75 or maybe 70 and 90% of Earth's greenhouse effect is caused by water vapor and clouds. It is a natural effect. And so if you look at carbon dioxide, only 4 of every 10,000 molecules in the atmosphere are carbon dioxide, a very, very small percent. And the amount that our industry could have put into the atmosphere in all of our history is only a fraction of one of those 4 molecules. And so the next thing you can do is you can break down the greenhouse effect. And you can say, okay, we said, let's be conservative, about 75% of Earth's greenhouse effect. And again, remember, this is what's blamed on dangerous global warming. About 75% is due to water vapor and clouds. About a quarter of it is then due to carbon dioxide, methane, and other gases. But then you need to say, well, how much of that last quarter is due to our industries versus nature? Because the oceans have 50 times as much carbon dioxide dissolved as is in the atmosphere. And the oceans are always releasing carbon dioxide and absorbing it. When plants die, they emit carbon dioxide. And when they grow, they absorb it from the atmosphere. And then we have volcanoes, both above the surface of the ocean and about 10 times as many under the surface of the ocean, that are putting gases in the environment all the time, including carbon dioxide. And so when you roll this all together, you find out that nature puts 20 times as much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere every day as all of our industries, and removes about the same amount. It's really dominated by nature. And so humans are responsible for only about 1 or 2 parts per 100 of Earth's greenhouse effect. Very, very small. And that means if we eliminate all emissions, we may not be able to even measure the difference in global temperatures. And so those are the numbers that you never hear, that water vapor is the dominant gas, that nature puts much more CO2 in the atmosphere. Nevertheless, we have every community trying to be net zero, and 27 conferences of the parties now, they meet every year, and 34,000 people this year. Very, 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 very crazy.
The other thing that we don't hear is, we often hear, it's drummed into our head, that CO2 is a pollutant when in fact it's a nutrient. I mean, it's without it, life would not be possible on this planet. But I, you know, Dr. Patrick Moore, the co-founder of Greenpeace, is often saying that, you know, greenhouse farmers will pump 1,200 parts per million of CO2. That's optimal. It seems to be optimal for plant growth.
Absolutely.
And yet we have, what, 450 parts per million? He says that we're actually on a CO2 starvation diet. What are your thoughts?
Yes, we are very low. Dr. Will Happer of Princeton has said similar things. We're in a little bit of a carbon dioxide drought. Yeah, when I present to groups, I like to ask what I call a zany question. I say, what do cannabis growers know that climate scientists don't apparently know? And the answer is that carbon dioxide is plant food. It makes plants grow. And as you say, every marijuana grower worth his or her salt is pumping carbon dioxide into the greenhouse. And I show a few images of these tanks people are using to get their crop to grow bigger and faster. And nevertheless, carbon dioxide is called a pollutant. We inhale only a trace of CO2, as I've talked about, but as we burn sugars in our body, as we do continuously, we generate carbon dioxide. So every time each one of us exhales, we exhale 100 times the concentration of the CO2 in the atmosphere. And so CO2 is great for plants. With higher levels of carbon dioxide, plants get bigger fruits, they get bigger vegetables, They get thicker tree trunks. They get bigger root systems. They're more resistant to drought. Literally, if there's one compound we can put in the biosphere that is absolutely great for the biosphere, carbon dioxide is that compound. Yet today we have every company and every university counting their carbon dioxide footprint. Very, very foolish. So you're right on that. We shouldn't be calling it a pollutant.
So in this mad rush to reduce CO2, is this likely to affect crop yields? I mean, are we in fact perhaps causing famine and drought by taking CO2 out of the atmosphere when in fact we should be putting more into the atmosphere?
Well, there's really no evidence that famine is getting worse, for example. Another chart I like to use shows the history of famine. Now we have globally maybe 100,000 people die each year. It's probably more like a decade. But back in the 1920s, we had 10 million people dying from famine every decade. And so the effects of famine are way, way down. The effects of deaths from disaster are down. There's an international organization whose name escapes me, but they plot deaths from disaster, earthquakes, hurricanes, storms, droughts, floods, and those are way, way down as well. Maybe 98% down from early in the century. And if you can also go to every country in the world and look at agricultural output, and more than 90% of them show a steady uptick in output, steady growth. Nevertheless, we have the United Nations. We have many other people saying, well, this global warming is going to cause crop failures and we won't have enough food. But there's no evidence, again, of that. You can go nation by nation and see that everybody is growing more because of the tremendous gains in agriculture. And oh, by the way, CO2 helps plants as well. it's another chunk of evidence that is just flat out wrong, regardless of what you hear in the press.
Let's talk about hydrocarbons, fossil fuels, which are supposedly responsible, for the uptick in temperatures and so forth. And the idea that, so much of this Earth is inhospitable for like 6 months of the year. Where would we be without, burning natural gas and oil and even coal, not only to, for the power grid, but also to heat our homes? Shouldn't we be more concerned about people freezing than, an increase in the temperature?
Well, what I call the hydrocarbon revolution has shaped modern society. Hydrocarbons are those materials that have carbons and hydrogen. Primarily, they are oil, petroleum, natural gas, but we also include coal in there. But back about the 1700s, 1800s, when we were having the Industrial Revolution, we also had a hydrocarbon revolution. And we started using coal to be able to power machinery and mine things. And we started, we had a transportation revolution as part of the hydrocarbon revolution. Internal combustion engine cars and refining of gasoline and diesel fuel from oil. And then we had electricity, the biggest one of all. When Thomas Edison did his first New York City power plant, he didn't burn wood because wood was very poor in terms of energy output. He burned coal, and all of our trains ran on coal. And so if you plot modern GNP growth, a curve of that, and you plot hydrocarbon use, or you plot emissions, let's say, that represent hydrocarbons, you see a very high correlation. Modern society is based on hydrocarbon fuels. We still have 91% of all transportation is powered by oil. Another 4% is powered by natural gas. I think 1% is powered by biofuels. 3% by biofuels and 1% electric. So we're dominated there. 99% of all airline transportation comes from biofuels. And if you even look, another one of my favorite charts is to talk about energy usage over the last 20 or 30 years. The share of coal, oil, and gas is still about 82% that powers a global society. That's the same it was back in 1989. And so despite the fact that we've spent almost $5 trillion now on renewables, wind and solar, they still cannot replace the hydrocarbon use. I've got another graph I call the energy mountain graph, which is a black graph going up, which shows global energy consumption, which has tripled since 1965. And global energy consumption has actually accelerated since the year 2000. And then I plot wind and solar way down at the bottom. We've never had a year when the growth in renewables has been able to account for the growth in world energy. And so they can't even account for the growth, let alone replace our traditional hydrocarbon fuels. And so as a result, as you say, Mr. Gore and others are ringing the alarms. You know, we've got to do all these things because we're just not getting there in their opinion.
Steve, we'll take a quick time out, come back, and continue to discuss about sustainable energy and climate change. Back with more in a moment.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Have you ever wondered why we call French fries French fries? Or why something is the greatest thing since sliced bread? There are answers to those questions. Everything Everywhere Daily is a podcast for curious people who want to learn more about the world around them. Every day, you'll learn something new about things you never knew you didn't know. Subjects include history, science, geography, mathematics, and culture. If you're a curious person and want to learn more about the world you live in, just subscribe to Everything Everywhere Daily wherever you cast your pod.
The truth will set you free. But first, it will really tick you off. Welcome back to Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
And we're back with Steve Gorham, Executive Director of the Climate Science Coalition of America and the author of Outside the Green Box, Rethinking Sustainable Development. We're talking about, you know, all of the benefits from fossil fuels or hydrocarbons and the prosperity that has been created as a result. Much of that, though, has been denied to the developing world. For example, recently, I think President Biden offered, I think it was something like $8 billion to South Africa to shut down one of their, I believe it was a nuclear plant. And I have a niece that lives in Cape Town. And every week, or every day, actually, there's an allotted period of time where there's no electricity. These aren't rolling blackouts. It's a daily routine now. I mean, this is going to set back Africa and the developing world decades.
Yeah. It is constraining it. There are about 600 people without access to electricity, and there are about 2 billion that have very poor access, that have blackouts for long periods in every day. And those are in India, in Africa, Southeast Asia. And as you say, we have many organizations now that are not wanting to lend on coal. By the way, coal is still the biggest source of electricity worldwide, and it's actually doing record this year. Germany just restarted 28 coal plants because of the energy crisis over there. We can get into that. But yeah, the World Bank and many other groups and financial groups are saying we won't lend to coal projects. We won't lend to natural gas projects in many cases. China is one of those that is lending to those projects across the world, but it's very, very tough. And wind and solar just can't do it. There's a fundamental difference wind and solar are intermittent. And if you're trying to run a factory and you have to have continuous processes, you can't have the electricity goes out. It ruins your lines. It ruins your materials. It ruins your chemicals, whatever. So we really have to have always on a reliable energy sources. That's coal, that's natural gas. That can be hydro, but it isn't wind and solar. Nevertheless, the wealthy nations are trying to push those ideas on the developing nations, as you say.
Let's talk about the transition to green technology. Let's talk about electric vehicles, for example.
Right.
The argument that they are ethical and sustainable just kind of disabuses of that notion, if you could.
Well, the push for electric vehicles is when they drive, they don't emit anything, basically. They don't emit carbon dioxide. If you drive the great news about internal combustion engine cars in the wealthy nations like the United States and Europe is we have almost no emissions anymore. The volatile organic compounds are down 98% from 1980. They're very, very clean. The only thing that comes out of your car engine, your internal combustion engine car, is water vapor and carbon dioxide. That's basically the only thing that comes out of your tailpipe. But because carbon dioxide is demonized, they're saying, well, we have to force everyone to use electric vehicles. And there are many, many problems with electric vehicles. First, they're heavier than regular cars. And that is because of the size of the battery. If you take a Honda Civic, for example, it's got a 12.4 gallon gas tank. It can go 366 miles on 77.5 pounds of fuel that you put in that gas tank. So if you say, okay, I'm gonna do an electric vehicle like a Chevy Volt, and I'm gonna put in a 77.5 pound battery, you can only go 21 miles. You can't go 360 miles. So you have to scale up that battery by a factor of 17. And so as a result, electric vehicles are going to be about 50% heavier than regular gasoline or diesel cars. And we're going to have more deaths and injuries from collisions. Another big issue is what happens in cold weather. Well, we found out this year and last year that if you have an EV and it gets down to about 10 degrees Fahrenheit, it literally will not charge. And it gets about half the mileage. And Canada, I noticed, in December said they're going to go to a zero emissions mandate by 2035. And so they want everybody to get an electric vehicle. Well, you're not going to be able to drive these in the winter.
Good luck in Winnipeg. Yeah.
How the heck can you have an electric vehicle? You just flat out cannot drive the vehicle unless you're going to have a heated garage that you can put it in. It's not going to charge. And once you get outside the heated garage, you don't get any mileage. You get about half the miles. Now, a gasoline or a diesel car also has waste heat. And so you heat your vehicle with the waste heat in cold weather, but an EV doesn't have the waste heat. So you have to spend part of your battery power to heat your vehicle. These things just are not going to work in the winter. So Canada and other cities like Chicago, which I live in sometimes, need to get their heads screwed on straight and get rid of these mandates.
Well, what about the carbon footprint to manufacture an EV vehicle versus an internal combustion engine? I've read something about how you would have to drive an EV about 100,000 kilometers before you actually start to reap any CO2 savings, I guess.
I think that's about right. The International Energy Agency says it takes about, you end up with about half of the emissions of carbon dioxide from an EV if you consider all things. But you're right, it takes quite a while before you break even when you have to drive. Let's consider some other things, though. Public charging is really a big problem. And I've spoken to a number of groups that gasoline and convenience store owners, And they're not really too interested in putting in these charging stations. So here's the comparison. If you put in a gasoline pump, it costs about $20,000. If you put in a high-speed EV charger, it costs about $100,000, five times as much. Now, in a gasoline pump, worst case, somebody can fill up in 6 minutes. Usually it's less than that. And in a 12-hour day, that's about 120 customers. EV takes 30 minutes to do the charge, so you can serve about 20 or 25 customers. So not only does it cost five times the capital investment, but you can serve one-fifth of the customers. The other thing is a lot of these charging stations are off in a parking lot or something. And, you know, my wife doesn't want to go there, sit in the dark, wait 30 minutes in an unattended parking lot. There are safety issues. So what's going to happen with these chargers is, I predict, if these take off, we're going to have government paying utilities, subsidizing utilities to do this, and it's going to come out of everybody's electric rate because the business case is not there. Nobody's making money on these chargers. Let me give you another example here. Electrify America put out a report in October. They're the second largest charging company in the U.S. behind Tesla. They're pretty far behind. They have 3,500 charging stations. They put out a press release in October saying in 2021, they had 1.45 million customer charging sessions. Well, that sounds like a lot, but if you drive that by, you divide their number of charging stations and 365 days in a year, you find they're only getting a little over one charging session per charger per day. Well, of course that's going to improve, but nobody can run a business like that. This thing costs $100,000. So again, all these companies, I wouldn't invest in any of these charging companies. If this comes to pass, I think it's going to be utilities and it's going to come out of ratepayers' bills to fund these things and out of government subsidies. It just doesn't make business sense.
All right, we'll take another time out. Steve Gorham stays with us.
We all enjoy a little mystery. Every other week, One Strange Thing presents forgotten stories from America's newspaper archives. They all have something in common, a single element that can't quite be explained. Join us on One Strange Thing, and you'll hear about a man who was literally stricken with genius. A 21st century child who remembered piloting a World War II bomber. A mysterious, unidentifiable blob in Texas. And then there was the lizard man stalking through small-town South Carolina. From cryptids and disappearances to modern-day miracles, One Strange Thing brings you stories that are very real and just a little otherworldly. Subscribe now, wherever you listen.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to be buried in an avalanche?
Weird foreign feeling of despair.
Or how it feels to crash a skydive?
I remember hearing a thud, feeling my body hit the ground.
Or how you would react if you were being attacked by an alligator?
At the end of my leg is this huge alligator head on my leg.
These are the stories you'll hear on the podcast called What Was That Like? True stories told by the actual person who went through it. You'll hear from a victim of an attack.
Dragging me into the bathroom and saying, I'm going to kill you, now you're going to die.
You'll hear from a man who discovered a baby.
How could this be? How could there be a baby on the ground?
And you'll hear actual 911 calls.
Clinky County 911. There's a man at my back door. He's trying to get in.
What Was That Like is a podcast about real people in unreal situations. Search for What Was That Like on any podcast app or at whatwasthatlike.com.
Welcome back to Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
Steve Gorham stays with us, executive director of the Climate Science Coalition of America, author of, well, the latest is Outside the Green Box, Rethinking Sustainable Development. We were talking about electric vehicles. What about the in terms of the extraction of raw materials, is there even enough cobalt or lithium on the planet to replace, let's say, the entire fleet of all vehicles I don't know, in the United Kingdom, for example?
Right, probably not. That is a big issue. We have currently a pretty big cost gap between diesel and gasoline cars and electric vehicles. An example, again, a 2022 Toyota Corolla, about $20,000 MSRP, 2022 Chevy Bolt, $31,000, about a 54% premium. Now, the problem with these is the battery prices have come down for many years, but in the last year and a half, they've gone way up, up by about 60%. And a big reason is metals. To get enough metals for 1,000-pound battery, you need to move about 500,000 pounds of rock. And so it's a big, big deal. And so we have many, many people saying that we're going to get to 50% EVs or more by 2040. I have a much lower projection. And the reason is that I think the cost of these metals is going to remain very high. Lithium, copper, they're talking about copper shortages over the next 10 years. Cobalt, nickel, as you say, those are the big ones. Those prices are going to stay high. It takes a long time to set up a mine. Again, the International Energy Agency says the typical copper mine takes 16 and a half years from first concept to actually getting metal out of it. And yet we're talking about increasing lithium by a factor of 10, increasing global copper output by a factor of 50% just to handle electric vehicles. I think cobalt is like three times and nickel is three or four times. So these are very, very big numbers. They also come from places where, you know, it's not the best thing. The most of this, for example, cobalt comes from the Republic of Congo, I believe, and there is forced labor, there's child labor there. The value chain and the mining chain on these is not something to be proud of typically. But we have all these people pushing us toward EVs. It's sure going to be interesting, but I think we're going to run into some big issues.
Well, another issue, there was a Norwegian shipping line that just the other day announced that they're not going to allow electric vehicles or even hybrids on their ferries because one of them caught fire. They couldn't extinguish it. The whole ship went down. So I'm imagining that in the future, these shipping companies won't be able to get insurance. They won't be able to export electric vehicles from overseas to come into the North American market and vice versa. I don't think they saw that one coming.
Well, you're right. And there was a big cargo ship in the Atlantic that went down too, that was full of EVs and had a big fire and it went down. And Norway is interesting because they have like a 70% EV penetration on annual sales. So it's a big EV country. But yeah, the problem with these batteries is they can combust. General Motors recalled 140,000 Bolts because the batteries would spontaneously combust. They'd be just sitting out, sitting in somebody's garage or sitting out on the driveway, and they'd catch on fire. Back when we had the hurricane, I can't remember which one come through Florida this fall, all that flooding, they were having EV fires afterwards because these batteries would get wet. And they would have a little bit of a defect then, and then they would spontaneously burst into flames. So I had these big fields with cars that were widely separated so they wouldn't burn each other up. Watch for this to happen in California without the flooding. California is the big EV state. We're going to have a whole bunch of battery car fires there. And another thing to beware of, you know, Vice President Kamala Harris has talked about how she loves electric buses. I really have a lot of fear for that. I've advised my family to try and avoid them. But wait till we get one of these. I have pictures of buses that have combusted in China and in Europe, and they just spontaneously go up. They've got a picture of these things. I sure hope that doesn't happen with 20 or 25 kids on board. But, you know, we march off in these directions and don't consider the consequences. But you're right. Issues with EV combustion is a big deal as well.
So what's behind all of this? I mean, surely the ruling class, they realize that, you know, there's no scientific basis for this. There's no business argument for this. What is this all about? Is it just a huge transfer of wealth? What's going on here?
No, I do think the people that are demanding this, Al Gore and others, really believe that climate change is a problem, that we're hurting the planet, we have to fix it. But it has become the you know, the number one reason for everything. If you look at utilities now, they're under so much pressure from the states, the U.S. Utilities. They are. It used to be reliability and cost to the ratepayer. Those have been submerged behind reduction in emissions. And so we have, they're buying wind and solar everywhere. And the reliability of the grid is declining in the United States. It's gotten about 100% worse than it was. It's not a big number yet, 6 or 7 years ago, but it's going to go that way. We had, just to take a tangent, the Northeast ISO, the Northeast region of the six states, Maine and Massachusetts, Vermont, Connecticut, et cetera, did a study, because all of those states are pushing them to go 90% renewables. And they figure out that if they had a 300% overcapacity, in other words, you take the normal electricity usage and you increase it by a factor of three, with all this wind and solar, they would still have, and they put in a lot of batteries as well, they would still have, I think it was 25 days a year when they were going to have rolling blackouts, and another possible 15 days when it was at high risk. So you put in these, and by the way, when you have these blackouts, people die. In Texas, we had more than 200 people die with the blackouts in 2021. And a lot of that was because they undercalled the demand and we had a lot of renewables on the grid. But we're headed that way. Canada actually is fairly well blessed. You have 60% of your electricity from hydropower, 15% from nuclear. So if any country can get close to net zero, Canada can. Brazil probably can. Norway can. But it's not going to happen in most places in the world. We're just going to have to swing back towards hydrocarbons.
Yeah, and even if we did reach net zero, what difference would it make? I mean, Canada, in terms of you know, our contribution to CO2, it seems like they're intent on taking us back to the dark ages.
Well, they ought to have a group up there, Canadians for Global Warming, right? I think we need one in Chicago, too. I just like the warm weather. I mean, the idea that warm weather is bad for you. Here's another one, too. The idea that warm weather is bad for you is crazy. We had like 100 medical groups 2 or 3 years ago that came out that said that climate change was a health issue for people in the United States. But you start to look at the data and you go, okay, when do people get sick? Well, more people had COVID in all the winter months. You go to every country in the world. I haven't been to all of them, but they get COVID in the winter months. Our flu season is during the winter months when it's colder. People don't get flu in the summer. And if you look at the data, more people die every winter in every country in either the northern or southern hemisphere than in the summer. Warm weather is good for people. And then the other thing is, why do people retire to Florida and Texas and Arizona? Don't they know that warm climates are dangerous? How foolish are they? We should all be moving to Canada, right? I mean, it's just beyond common sense.
Well, despite this, I mean, the world doesn't seem to be transitioning to green. It's transitioning back to fossil fuel. You mentioned Germany, the UK now buying coal. Germany and Japan came looking for our liquid natural gas, but unfortunately our prime minister couldn't see the business argument for about a deal that would have probably been about $1/3 trillion in our coffers. We could sure use that.
But yeah, we should talk about the world energy crisis a little bit.
Yes, let's do that.
Which is the Europe-centered crisis. So we've had, let me just find what I'm looking for here, data-wise. So there have been a lot of headlines about a world energy crisis over the last year or so. And most of those say that our problem is due to COVID disruption, supply chain, and then Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But there are bigger factors. One is an underinvestment in oil and gas, and then also the green energy policies. If you look at investment in exploration and drilling for oil and gas, that rose from 2010, about $500 billion a year, up to almost $800 billion a year in 2014. But then it's been declining for the last 7 or 8 years. And we have people going around saying, like Fatih Birol, executive director of the International Energy Agency, says, if governments are serious about the climate crisis, there can be no new investments in oil, gas, and coal. And so investment has been falling off. It's down to below just a little above $300 billion in 2020, down quite a bit from where it was. And so when we recovered from COVID, we had a rise in world oil prices. They were down about $20 a barrel. And 3 months before the invasion of Ukraine, they had gone up to $80 a barrel. And then in Europe, what Europe has done is they have become very dependent on wind, solar, intermittent sources, and natural gas. Europe closed 100 nuclear plants in the last decade, 34 in England and 30 in Germany, and 23 nations signed pledges saying we weren't going to use coal anymore. And so they got very dependent on intermittents, wind and solar and natural gas. For example, Netherlands was 78% wind, solar, and gas. UK, 64% wind, solar, and gas. And another big thing is almost all that gas is imported. The European Community did a study in 2017 that said there were more than 40 European shale fields that had oil and gas. There's a big one called the Finniscandian Shield from the Baltics on the east, all the way over to England, covers all of Northern Europe. Well, they haven't fractured any of those. They decided they're going to import all of it. And by the way, a big chunk of that was from Russia. And so what happens, then what happened in 2021 is the wind didn't blow throughout much of the year. The electricity output from wind in France, Germany, and the UK was down about 20 to 30% for the year. So what they did was they burned natural gas. They didn't have any other choice. And by the end of 2021, gas prices were way up. They had a shortage. Gas prices are typically about 13 to 18 euros per megawatt hour is how they measure it. That was back in early 2021. It had gone up to 80 euros per megawatt hour, up by a factor of 7. This was by December of 2021, 3 months before the invasion of Ukraine. And so this crisis was well underway. Then we had the Ukraine thing, and then they jumped much higher. Electricity, similarly, had gone up by a factor of 6 by December of 2021. Now it's still up 7 or 8 times. Imagine paying $1,000 a month for your energy bill if you have a house. I mean, it's just, and so they're shutting down industries out there. They are restaurants in Brussels aren't cooking anything anymore. They're not even put out everything. Everybody's eating a salad. The Hungarian schools are putting wood stoves in their schools because they didn't think they'd have gas. In England, they're saying a shower with a friend or don't shower at all. I mean, it really is a drop in standard of living. Yet we still have the leaders in Europe saying, what we need is more wind and solar. If we get more wind and solar, you know, you can't turn up the wind and solar. It just doesn't work that way.
As this final question, Steve, as this energy crisis, I mean, you have people, and thank God the winter isn't quite as severe in Europe as they were thinking, and
right.
It could have been a catastrophe, but you have people going into the Black Forest and collecting wood to burn in their houses. Is this going to be the wake-up call? Are the people going to rise up and basically, you know, tell their leaders enough of this madness? Are we going to wake up from this, as you call it, the mad world of climatism?
Well, I think so. I think net zero is going to become a hated term. I think people are eventually going to say, look, you're ruining our electrical system. They're already doing it in Europe. Northeast U.S. is on track for that as well. Australia has some big issues. They don't have much hydropower there. They have no nuclear. They want to go all wind and solar. So we're going to see a big pullback, but it's going to take decades. I really think the world is marching down this road. It's going to take a long, long time till they come back to their senses.
Steve, a great pleasure. I hope we can do this again. Outside the Green Box, Rethinking Sustainable Development. And the website, just go into the notes for this episode, but it's stevegorham.com. Great to meet you and speak with you.
Thank you, Richard.
A new Richard Serrett's Strange Planet drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.